and the longest is the present reign of al-Bashir of nearly 30 years. On the other hand, three democratically elected civilian government ruled for just only 10 years. And you see the disparity between army rule and civilian rule. Thus, democracy was not given enough time to mature and to take root. But, I think there is a but, wrangling among political parties is a major problem among civilian politics of Sudan. And I wouldn't be surprised if this is going to happen now, as allocation of positions within the cabinet, as well as what shall be done about al-Bashir regime, in view of the brutality and waging war and all sorts of things since he assumed power in 1989. Now, each military coup in the Sudan is toppled by civilian protests. As you've seen on television, as you read in newspaper, people are occupying the space outside the military headquarters, and they are determined, typical Sudanese, they are determined to stay it out, come what may. One could understand their anger. For 30 years, situation are not very good economically. I was in December, January in Sudan, and I saw the queues for bread, and you are only allowed one or two pieces of bread, as well as I have seen people shot. I don't know what happens to the chaps, six or seven soldiers. I was sitting near Comboni School, and then suddenly there was shooting taking place, and everybody was scattered. And so we'd ask, and they were following somebody, apparently later on I learned. He was on his mobile telephone, and the army thought he was actually taking photograph of a number of military vehicle outside the gold market, and therefore they were chasing him. So I don't know what happened to him, whether he was killed or not, poor chap. So you could see the putting fear all the time, those army people. I saw another demonstration outside the main Khartoum hospital with tear gas and also lashing at people with their sticks, the security people. But what is really remarkable and never happened before is that within 1 week, three rulers came to rule in very unstable situation. Never happened before, not only in Sudan, but anywhere else in the Middle East and Africa. And one very important feature of the protest is the predominance of young people, and particularly the participation of women. The anguish, as well as their situation economically, lack of jobs, and also the security apparatus after many of them, and therefore they are risking their life, and they are indeed estimate, as Sarah may have to talk about, the number of people killed or injured. Some people say it's 50, 80, and 100, 200 to 300 were injured. So people are determined to sit it out outside the headquarters in order to achieve, and as you may see on television, that there still is a deadlock between the army and the civilian. Now, one of the problems of Sudan is that the tradition of multi-party democracy, or one-party system to start with, under Nimeiri from 1969 until 1985, the Sudan Socialist Union, modeled on the Egyptian experience, has failed dismally. And also, al-Bashir National Congress Party has failed to achieve the necessary projected development much needed to transform the Sudanese economy and culture. The two parties, Sudan Socialist Union as well as the National Congress Party, they really became both parties as a dumping places for unwanted civil servants, dismissed ministers, and supporters of the government in power. More importantly, there was no rapport, and that's very essential throughout independence of the Sudan. There was no rapport between urban center and rural areas. What you see, what you hear is all happening in Khartoum, in Atbara, in Port Sudan. These are urban centers. But what happens outside is no concern, either of the army or the educated people in the Sudan. Always been a gap between them, sadly. And therefore, these two parties, created by Nimeiri and al-Bashir, were created by educated people for the benefit of the educated people. And the people in power, they have benefited, and scale of corruption is going to come out sooner or later, I hope, how much those people embezzled money from ordinary Sudanese. Now, again, the two parties, different decades, have failed to address the ethnic and political exclusivity of certain section of the society, whether it's Ajali or Shaigi or Dongolawi or what. But the rest are really, I mean, Darfur is one of the problems since our time in the 60s, and as I think my colleague at that time, Professor Wendy James with me, that they were being marginalized Darfurian. If I remember correctly, there's one minister in the whole government of the Sudan during democratic time, just one minister from Darfur, no economic development. So that is a major problem which led to Darfurians trying to take matter in their hands. And secondly, that the two parties failed to bring Sudanese together. The diverse communities, not only Darfurian, but also the South, which now they fought two civil wars to achieve independence, and Southern Kordofan, as well as the Nuba Mountains, and Darfurian. Still, they are there. I don't know what will happen in the future. I have no idea. Now, also, the two parties failed to counter the idea of fragmentation. When we went to the Sudan in the 60s, there's one Sudan. Though rambling was already there in the south, civil war was going on at that time. But that side of it is that nowadays it's increasing fragmentation rather than bringing people together. People hope that the future government of Sudan civilian will try and address this very important issue in Sudan politics as well as Sudan society. The longer the army stays, and I said the longest is al-Bashir, 30 years, the more difficult it becomes to dislodge the institution it has created. Al-Bashir regime specifically has politicized all the institution of the state. Since 1989, he politicized the judiciary, education, medicine, the economy, the market. Everywhere you go, it must be National Congress Party and his own people, handpicked. Anybody outside his political parameter are out. They don't get any job. And hence, migration was very common during al-Bashir regime. It is very difficult to turn the whole civil service now, the army, the police and security forces, into the service of the state. Because hitherto, these three, the army, the security, as well as the police service, are in the service of the National Congress Party and al-Bashir specifically. And you get nowadays conflict between the security and the army as well as the police. Now, hitherto, and that's another problem, not only of Sudan, but I think it's throughout the Middle East, is that the political association is based on patronage. This patronage, be it political, whether you belong to a Communist Party, the Ba'athist Party, or the Ummah Party, or National Democratic Party, and then religious, whether you are a Khatmist, you are a Mahdist, you are a Muslim brother, or you are this and that, or tribal, either Ja'li or either Shaigi and the rest, or ethnic, are you Southerners, are you African, are you Arab, are you from the East, are you from the Bijas, and so forth, so on. So it got all these permutation and difficult situation to address. These associations reflect really the nature of Sudanese society and composition. Thus consensus is very difficult to achieve, but vital for legitimacy. If there is no consensus, and I believe at the moment it's going to be very difficult for all political parties to reach consensus about some broad outline, say how to provide bread, how to provide petrol, not, you know, the philosophy of communism or Ba'athism or anything. I don't think this will serve a purpose. Ordinary Sudanese need to reclaim their ordinary life back again. Again, hitherto, meritocracy, that people are appointed on their efficiency, on their qualification, on their ability, is really entertained. You know, the meritocracy is political offices, particularly in military regime, is all allocated to their own people. Now, I have been talking about this for 40 years, that one of the problems of the Middle East and Sudan and Africa is the shifting alliance of the educated class. That they shift allegiance between the army and civilian, and they are circulated from one regime to another. This is really motivated by self-interest, and it is conducive to political instability and the legitimacy of the state. And indeed, if you look at al-Bashir, if you go outside Khartoum, who believes? Al-Bashir, he says, well, it's nothing to do with us. This is Nas al-Khartoum. This is people of Khartoum. Nothing to do with us. Now, Sudanese people are resilient, and recent protests outside the military headquarters have shown their tenacity and determination to sit it out for the realization of their demands and aspiration. I think it is time for a civilian government, as the Sudanese have endured army rule for many decades and suffered underneath that. There are able technocrat bureaucrats, as we have seen some of here in Oxford, in London, anywhere else, who are really able to run and efficiently and impartially the state institution for the benefit of the Sudanese people as a whole. A monumental task is awaiting any next government to bring stability, first and foremost, to track down the vast amount of money stolen from the state. C, and the last, is to create employment for the young who have been marginalized, both economically and politically. One has to look at the diaspora of Northern Sudanese as well as Southern Sudanese, as our last conference was, and in various countries and across the continent of the world, to realize the loss of their expertise to their motherland. This is the case in Africa, in the Middle East, and Asia, all those immigrants coming across. So again, this is a major problem, how to attract back the able Sudanese who could help their country to be back on its feet. Now, the diversity of the country, Sudan is not uniform by any means, must be given equal right in any future constitution. Hitherto, no single political or religious party have succeeded in ruling or unifying the country. Such recognition will bring about new spirit of reconciliation and avoid tension, feeling of alienation, and ambition for separation. The army does not want, at the moment, to lose power and privilege, and thus its leaders are taking time over the composition of the sovereign council, as well as, let alone, say, the cabinet, who is going to be in cabinet. This is going to be a major problem to them. This stance is not in the interest of democracy or tackling the legacy of al-Bashir regime. Finally, it is up to the Sudanese to shape their future government and to take matters in their hands. So thank you for listening, and I will hand you now to... Thank you.
Apologies, sir. I should have introduced you to her. She introduced herself as consultant pediatrician. She is president of Sudan Doctors Union, United Kingdom branch, as well as Northern Ireland. She is fellow of the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health. She is politically active and very active member of the Sudanese diaspora.
Thank you, Ahmed, and thank you, Richard. And I'll try to keep my time, and I'm very honored to be here to discuss the situation in Sudan and really to reflect and hear what people think from the outside. I'm Sara Abdeljail. I'm not a politician. I'm a consultant pediatrician, and I'm a professional. I'm the Sudan Doctors Union president. And I think through my talk, you will understand where we come in this sort of uprising and the role of the professionals. So at the moment, I think Sudan is at a critical situation. This is a very timely meeting to discuss how people can progress forward. At the moment, the street work is done, and it's very clear that there is unity, and this unity is among all sectors, in cities and urban areas, but it's as well in villages and other communities. So it is sort of generalized, it's not centralized. However, I think Rosaline is among the audience. What I have said before, we feel like we are in an aeroplane. We can see the destination, we can see this is where we should land, but we are unable to land safely because there is turbulence. And that is expected after 30 years of, you know, oppression, and obviously the Islamic front line are fighting because they don't want to hand over the regime peacefully. The journey has been a very long journey, and we cannot claim that it's only in December that the Sudan uprising managed to change things. It has been an ongoing resistance in the last 30 years, and the cumulative effect ended in what we have seen in December. It has never been about bread and fuel. It took us a lot of effort to convince the international community, the policymakers, and the media that it's not about bread, that there is genuine legitimate request that the people of Sudan would like this regime to go away and they would like to shape their future. So this is one of the street art that has been taking place since the 6th of April. And what is happening at the moment that the fighters or the forces for freedom and change has changed from the traditional resistance that Ahmed talked about. It's no more about the political parties on their own. It's no more about the communists and the Islamists. It is about the professionals, the civil societies, the community leaders, women, and about youth. And it's in itself, we are very proud of this. We came together. There are challenges. We cannot say that 100% everybody is there. And there are teasing issues. But still, we managed to stick together, have one vision, and have one objective, and work towards that, and achieve, I would say, a lot of positive changes. The role of the Sudan Doctors Union, in the UK, our branch was established in 1976. The mother organization was established in 1948 in Sudan. And doctors have been always at the front line with other colleagues and other professionals. That's not new. It happened in the 60s, it happened in the 80s. Engineer Hashim Mohammed Ahmed is among the audience. And they have played always a role in the democracy and in change. And I think that comes sort of spontaneously, because in the last 30 years there has been destruction of the health services, and we do believe that's a human right violation. So people were not all, they didn't only die from, you know, bullets or being shot dead, they died because they couldn't access health services, and they died because they can't afford medication. So health for all and the concepts about the WHO does not apply. So the doctors have been participating and have been in strikes for the last 30 years, and recently they have been on strike since December. It's strike from the elected cases, but not from emergency cases. And I think the Sudan Professional Association managed to, I'll say, activate the legitimate unions which were demolished by the regime. And people gathered together. There was brainstorming, discussion about how can we achieve things. And there is a lot of learning about what happened in the past, what happened in September 2013, what's happening, you know, around, and how can we learn from the Arab Spring, so people don't say, oh, you can never achieve anything, you will end like this and this country. And actually trying to make sure that we face these challenges before they happen. This is some of the lists that have been, you know, typed during the early stage of the, I'll say, revolution, really, for those who died, who were killed and were shot. So you will find these names on just around the hospitals. The number that we understand, you know, sadly, there's about 117 who lost their lives since December. And this is a work that has been done by the Sudan Doctors Union and London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. It's been published, I think, 2 days or 3 days ago. So what is in the media about 40 to 50 is not true, but there are hundreds who are injured and there are 1,000 who were detained. And there was a change in the trend of the violence that being used. So at the beginning it was shoot to kill, but then it went into torture during detention, and then it went into medical torture, or what we call medical malpractice. So you are denied your medication, or, you know, there is sort of intentional delay so that you can develop complication. Apart from other types of torture that we would never know about, which is sexual abuse and sexual harassment, especially for women. So overall, the regime continued in different ways. It's not new. We know that's a regime that killed hundreds in Darfur with, you know, no justification at all and no explanation. This is our colleague, Babikir Yahya, Babikir Abdelhamid, a very junior doctor with a lot of, you know, hopes and ambition, who worked very hard in Darfur, and he went to work in different parts of Sudan. He was attending injured Sudanese protest in Burri when he was shot from a distance of 20 meters and he died. So that's just an example of what happened in the last 3 or 4 months. I met his sister in Newcastle. She's another doctor. I was amazed by how brave she was and how she was talking about, we have to achieve our objectives. We cannot give up and we cannot go backwards. And I think his story and the story of others is one of the things that is keeping us going on and on. It's really sad for me to see someone who could be my SHO, who was doing the right thing, who just been shot, in, you know, and died. Different slogans during the Sudan uprising, they have changed. So the culture in Sudan have changed. So I have my aunties who are women activists and since the 50s, and they were a bit surprised about these slogans, and they felt like this is not serious. We should be asking for freedom, for justice, for peace. What about this Tas Good Bes and Bashir Raja? Whereas for them, it felt like this is a completely different way of resistance because it's led by youth. And the group, they lived under the suppression and the oppression of this regime. And the way they think about it was different. But they proved that they are better than us and better than them because they managed to work together at the level of the neighborhoods, communities, and form the resistance committees. And they made different ways and different tools to achieve what we are celebrating today. For example, these are some of the leaflets that have been distributed, some of the balloons. All different ways have been used to make sure that people don't feel they are isolated, because obviously the way to succeed in peaceful resistance is about the number and about the unity, and both were achieved. The role of the Sudanese diaspora, what people have been all over the world, Sudanese, working very hard and campaigning. And I think there was success, as I said, to move it from a bread protest to people believing that it's a true uprising. So the first one is in Trafalgar Square, where it was happening every Saturday that Sudanese will come to Trafalgar Square. But it's not only about chanting in Oxford, in different places, but as well talking and giving leaflets. And this was like a European gathering for the Sudanese. They went to Brussels and they submitted as well a statement to the European Union, and then they went for a meeting. But there have been different ways the Sudanese diaspora have participated in this Sudan uprising. For example, donating money for the injured, for the casualties, for rehabilitation. And in Sudan Doctors Union, we have been working closely with our colleagues there in supporting the injured and these casualties. It continued on and on. People felt like it's going to come to an end. There was ups and downs. It was spreading into the small, actually, neighborhoods rather than going to the main roads in Khartoum. And people were thinking, yeah, it's maybe coming to an end. People are getting tired and, we may not be able to continue. And as I said, there has been, a lot of casualties. I think until the 6th of April, every week there is a timetable. This timetable is published in the Facebook, in Twitter. You will know what are you doing and where can you participate and how, in which part. There is a special name, like a symbolic name, for the protest on Thursday, and that has been including all sectors. And I think what is important about this, there has been multi-ethnic involvement, and people have override what people think about, discrimination and racism. And one of the slogans, which are really, became very famous, yeah, Unsuru Maghroor Kull Al Balad Darfur, you racist for Omar al-Bashir, we are all Darfur. So things, I think there is a lot of public awareness. We know the challenges, we know that we may fail, so people are trying to be proactive. The 6th of April, there was a sit-in in front of the headquarters. It's still going on. It is the new Sudan. When you go there, it is the new Sudan. What you can see inside the sit-in, there is a lot of arts, music, live debates. Some people are crying, some people are happy. This is my professor who is retired in Kerrar, and this is a very junior doctor there. Even the army offices. When we talk about the army, because this is now the main challenge, the senior army forces are pro-regime, but the middle rank and the lower rank are not. They have suffered the same thing that we have suffered as doctors. They have not been promoted, they have not been trained very well. All of the money is going towards the militia and the national intelligence services. So they're not happy with what is going on. But still we have the block from the senior officers who are pro-government. This is from the, I think, in Khartoum at night, and this shows as well the sit-in. Where are we at the moment? At the moment, the problem is how the military council will hand over the power peacefully and conditionally to a civilian government. The negotiation in itself for some people is conditional. It's like, why are you negotiating with us? We want to go for a civilian government. You should not be negotiating. Other things, let us just negotiate and come with a good deal so that we can move forward. And it is tricky, as Ahmed said, but the politicians don't have the say here, the political parties on their own, and they will never have after what happened in Sudan. What happened in Sudan is a complete change to the political dynamics and to the mosaic of Sudan. There is public consultation. People are every day talking and commenting on what's happening. They have requested a live stream of the negotiation so that they can watch and listen to what people are saying. They are commenting on those who go and negotiate and rejecting some of them and asking for some of the representatives to be changed. So it is not about X or Y or Z leading it. I think the people involvement has been very significant. However, we can never guess what's going to happen. We hope it's going to go to the better. When this uprising started, people were talking about the French resolution, were talking about what happened last year in France. People felt that they will never even reach that point at all. But actually, I think we have reached that point and beyond that point. There has involved all sectors, so this is like, there's a lot of cartoons saying that a teacher was killed, an engineer was killed, a doctor was killed in one of these photos, and people talking about women in Sudan and how they have been leading. And I always say that women in Sudan have been always leaders, but what happened that we were suppressed and we were thrown to the floor intentionally, but we managed to stand on our own and come back. So the resilience and the resistance of the Sudanese women is back, and that's as well. Well, a very positive effect. I think we are very proud of what we have achieved. We are very positive. We don't have a gloomy picture. We would like the international community to support us in our request, which is legitimate, the civilian government with representation from the army and the police. And I think I'm just going to show you a very short video from Khartoum City, just to give you a flavor about what happens every evening. Thank you.
Is Dr. Richard Bartrop. You have seen him around in the Sudanese program. He's one of the trustees of the program. He's a consultant specializing in work in conflict, development, and peace in the Middle East, North Africa, and the Horn of Africa. Since 2001, he has worked for the United Nations Development Program in Iraq, Libya, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, and Yemen. He has worked for the United Nations Peacekeeping Mission in South Sudan and for the United Kingdom Stabilization Unit in Iraq and the Syria peace talks. So Richard, you are welcome to give us your take on the international community and present situation.
Thank you, Ahmed. Thanks for the introduction. And thank you, Sarah, for your presentation and your remarks too. So as Ahmed has said, I'm going to focus on sort of the external engagement and response or non-response to the situation in Sudan. In a way, my overarching question is, can Sudan find a path to a peaceful post-Bashir transition? And what might the external contribution to this be? I'll preface this with just a couple of brief additional remarks about the background to the situation, just adding to what Ahmed and Sarah have said, which is that it was inexorable that Sudan would come to this point because of political, economic, and social factors, the 30-year presidency, the virtual one-party rule, the sort of dysfunctional party rule, economic developments, particularly from the 2000s, the imbalanced growth in the 2000s, followed by stagnation since 2011 and 2012, and seven or more years of austerity, in effect. And the social changes in Sudan over 30 years and more of rising urbanization, rising education, and, for want of other words, modernization. So it's been inevitable in some ways, or inexorable, that that would lead to a build-up of resentment and popular demand for change. And to produce sort of the change that is sought isn't just a matter of a change of leadership or just a change of ruling party or just a change of ruling authority. Obviously, policy and practice have to change. If the public demand, the revolutionaries' demand for change is to be met, or to be satisfied even moderately. So, moving to the core of what I want to talk about, the role of external actors and international community, invited or uninvited. Can Sudan find a path to a peaceful transition, and what might the external contribution be? Evidently, Sudanese are, principally in Sudan, but also in the diaspora, are at the forefront of trying to manage the situation. But also, inevitably, foreign states, regional and international organizations have varied interests in what happens in Sudan and what happens with the situation now. So looking at the external dimension, what has been happening in the few weeks since April the 6th? Firstly, let's look at states or countries acting alone or in limited coordination. On the one hand, there's a Saudi and UAE response, which has shown their inclination, the inclination of their policy, to strongly favour the TMC, the Transitional Military Council, and stability if it's in the hands of the military or similar. Saudi Arabia and the UAE were acquainted before with Abdel Fattah Burhan and also Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, the deputy in the Transitional Council, because of, I understand, their role in overseeing Sudanese troop deployments or contributions to the Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen. And reflecting the Saudi and Emirati and Gulf, or part of the Gulf inclination, has been the announcement in late April of a promise of $3 billion of aid for the Transitional Council in Sudan, starting with a $500 million deposit in the central bank, and it being indicated that the rest of that large support might be in the form of food, medicine and petroleum products. That kind of Saudi and Gulf ally assistance to Sudan is, and to Sudanese governments under Bashir or before, is a long-standing pattern. And as was picked up by media when the announcements were made, that offer from Saudi and the Emirates in particular wasn't welcomed by some protesters, with slogans being put up of the fashion of hands off Sudan. Some of that aid might not materialise, but there's little doubt that some of it will materialise. For example, some deposit in the central bank or in other accounts. Egypt's response, there's been little directly in the news, but we can expect that Egypt's policy will likely strongly favour the Transitional Military Council and continued military primacy in the administration of Sudan in the coming months or longer. We can note that the Egyptian president, Sisi, in mid to late April, in his capacity, in the capacity of Egypt holding the rotating presidency of the African Union at the moment, Sisi convened in Cairo an emergency summit to discuss Sudan and Libya. I'll come back to the Egyptian stance regarding the situation in Sudan. The third country that I'll just mention that one can consider maybe acting alone or in limited coordination regarding the situation in Sudan and whose policy can be significant is Russia. Maybe one can anticipate that its policy, as far as it's being revised following the 6th of April, may be to draw close to the Transitional Military Council. Its policy may be to regard it as a similar successor to Bashir. Worth remembering, noting the, as an indicator of Russian policy, there are small reports about Russian private military company assistance or military technical assistance in Sudan, as picked up by some media in small bits of evidence of it during the protests since December, but also some indicators of Russian-linked or Russian, purely Russian military assistance, advisory assistance, dating back to at least 2017. Then in the other category of sort of international response to the situation in Sudan that we should consider is multilateral, the multilateral actors. I'll mention five: the African Union, the Arab League, the European Union, the Troika, and the UN Security Council. The African Union has come out with the clearest and firmest line or response out of those multilateral actors. Beginning with, on the 15th of April, the African Union proposing a 15-day deadline for a handover to civilians, a handover from the Transitional Military Council to a civilian administration, which then, after the 23rd of April meeting in Cairo, convened by the Egyptian president, was then extended into a longer deadline, the two-month proposal for transition to a civilian administration. The Arab League, one can perhaps expect that the Arab League is unlikely to play a significant role or take a position that's significantly different from Egypt's policy on how to respond to the situation in Sudan. The Arab League issued a statement in mid-April, conventionally diplomatic, about the Transitional Council and talking about the need to maintain support, stability and consensus. Other issues are higher up the Arab League's agenda than Sudan, Libya and Algeria perhaps. The EU has made short statements, but they've also been rather limited, somewhat muted, perhaps muted by other priorities on the European Commission. The 11th of April and the 16th of April, the EU, European Commission, and Francesca Mogherini, the High Representative, issued statements which endorsed that formal initial position of the African Union, calling for a swift handover to a civilian government and saying that otherwise the crisis was likely to continue. And the EU statements have also advocated an inclusive dialogue between the Transitional Military Council, the protest movement, and political parties. And those statements have also, at least one of those statements from the EU, has made mention of the International Criminal Court arrest warrants. The Troika of Norway, the UK, and the United States in mid-April issued a statement calling for the Military Council to enter into an inclusive dialogue to effect a transition to civilian rule, and it voiced concern about the risk of violence, increased violence. Then the last of these multilateral actors that one can look at in considering how is the international community or how are state, regional states and regional organisations responding. The last that I want to mention is the UN Security Council, where it's notable that no formal statement has been issued by the Security Council. It has been unusually mute about the situation in Sudan. And that's unusual. One looks at the track record of the Security Council, given how much attention it has paid to Sudan in the past, particularly during the height of the Darfur conflict, and with the deployment of three UN peacekeeping missions, one of them joint with the African Union in Sudan and South Sudan. The background reason why the Security Council has been so muted about the situation in Sudan is the wider deterioration in the functioning of the Security Council, which has nothing to do with Sudan in itself. That wider deterioration in the ability of the UN Security Council during recent years, the deterioration in its ability to agree resolutions or even presidential statements, Security Council presidential statements, because of splits within the P5, the permanent five members. And to note, does that have an effect on response to situations in places like Sudan or South Sudan. It can do. In March, Russia abstained from a Security Council resolution renewing the peacekeeping mission in South Sudan. And late last year, it abstained from a resolution renewing the peacekeeping mission in Central African Republic. That kind of lack of cooperation could have consequences in the next 1-2 years for high-level international decisions about response to the situation in Sudan. What could happen in Sudan over the next 6 months or longer? I mention this briefly because this is the kind of question that international actors, regional states and organizations, international organizations, will implicitly or explicitly ask themselves in considering what they need to or want to do in response to the situation. While recognizing the euphoria for many Sudanese, the reasons for many Sudanese to feel positive or hopeful, many will also recognize that there are risks. For example, there are fault lines within the Sudan Armed Forces and the National Intelligence and Security Service. Look at the ascendancy, the rise to such a position of Mohamed Hamdan Dalgo or Himeti, and the position of the Rapid Support Forces. Another risk is polarization of identities in the context of the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir. Polarization of identities that might occur increasingly with regard or to the terminology of revolution, revolutionaries on the one hand and regime on the other. That kind of polarization has happened in the near neighborhood of Sudan during the past 10 years, in Libya and in Yemen and elsewhere and in Syria, and it can have consequences. Another risk is that the demand of the protest movement and the search of many Sudanese for reform, real reform, be it that it may harden among some, it may harden, and that hardening of reform demands about reform, may be matched by a hardening of intent among members of the former government and associates, hardening of their intent to hold on to power. And these risks, which in the coldly it's sensible to consider, are illustrated by examples from the region. Egypt, from 2011 to 2013, it had an interregnum after a popular uprising and a new president that was then overturned by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's coup 2 years later. Libya had a similar interregnum for 3 years, more or less, 2011 or 2.5 years from late 2011 to 2014, an initial transitional period where hope perhaps prevailed over fear and expectations of producing change and achieving change prevailed over fear of that possibility being squashed or crushed. And the initial transition broadly proceeded according to plan in 2012-13, but then a counter-reaction, counter-revolutionary forces accumulated and accelerated after the change in Egypt in 2013, and in effect a counter-revolutionary movement materialized in 2014, and that situation in Libya has now lasted 5 years. And the third large example to mention, recall from the region, of a transition after a long autocratic rule is Yemen's example of the abortive transition after Ali Abdullah Saleh. In 2012 there was a managed presidential election, there was a 2-year UN-backed transition plan, a national dialogue was conducted, and there was considerable hope that a positive transition would be developed. But it was all overturned by counteractions, including counteractions by the deposed former president or people around him, and by neighbouring countries, Saudi Arabia in particular. So, recommendations? I'll just briefly suggest ideas regarding three areas. regional actors, states, they often, in considering how to respond constructively, consider economy, mediation and dialogue as three areas in which they can try and contribute and support a transitional situation in a country. And the first, economy. Some regional and international actors have previously been considering what could they do to bring about beneficial economic change in Sudan. And perhaps if that is looked at, to be pursued pragmatically rather than idealistically. Idealistic radical economic reform tends to provoke deep resistance from people with vested interests and would only be possible on the back of a strong reformist transitional council. Mediation, can international actors contribute something by trying to initiate a mediation process, to mediate among the parties? It's not really on the cards at the moment, and there can be a risk that when international actors try to do that they set in place accidentally a framework for talks and solutions which is inappropriate for resolving a conflict. One example of that was, in a way, the IGAD-led South Sudan talks. In short, if mediation initiatives do get pursued by external states or international actors in the coming months or year, then perhaps they shouldn't be prescriptive about solutions in Sudan. A more promising area, possibly for constructive international support rather than pure mediation initiatives, may be support for Sudanese dialogue. What could be done to help Sudanese and inter-Sudanese cooperative dialogue about the would-be transition now? All the same, that still requires careful thought about how inter-Sudanese dialogue can be facilitated, who facilitates, what the specific subjects of dialogue are, and what expectations are realistic for reform. I'll stop there then.
Thank you very much.